Accession number 10170, reel number 4.
Mr. Walter Spencer, reel 4. What were the ground conditions like in the Ypres sector in 1916?
They were all fairly bad because it was all clay soil and the roads had been heavily shelled. Also, all the trenches, all round about the trenches, had been shelled. Having been there for some time, you found that the mud was churned up by... chiefly by the artillery who came up with the guns and with the ammunition which supplied the guns, and constantly churning up and going back again, it made it absolutely a quagmire. In fact, in some places, mules would get into the shell holes and they couldn't get them out. They'd be drowned in the mud and swill, and there was nothing they could do to get them out. The mules were carrying, by the way, the ammunition up in panniers on their backs.
And that had already started to happen in 1916?
Oh, yes, yes, it was bad even then.
How did the shelling and the conditions affect the trenches you were in the front line?
Well, generally speaking, we used to make one end, which we'd call the sump, which was lower than the remainder of the trench so far, you see, and then it would flow down there. There was always some mud in the bottom of the trenches, but not too bad. And if it did get very bad, of course, we had to what we call muck out.
What did that involve?
Well, mostly tins and that kind of thing, and ladle it out and throw it over the top.
Did you have duck boards in 1916?
Yes, we had duck boards, chiefly in the firing line, not much in the communication trenches, because the communication trenches were generally fairly good.
What about wire netting or
riveting?
Riveting.
Yes, well, we had sandbags on the top of the trench between us and the enemy to stop the fire, of course. Very little wire netting. There was barbed wire out in the front of the trenches, usually about 20 yards in front of the front line trench.
How wide would the belt be? How wide would the barbed wire be? How thick?
Oh, generally speaking, it varied a little, but it'd be somewhere about 2 yards wide, and it was erected on posts as far as possible, or it's just left out what we call stranded in kind of circles.
Did you have any dugouts at all in the front line at Ypres?
Yes, the dugouts were chiefly, of course, at the end of the communication trench between there and the front line. But there were some places, positions, where dugouts were actually in the front line. And they would be dug somewhere about 7 or 8 feet, varying in the quality of the soil and the number of persons who were disposed to do the job. But generally, they were habitable, and you could get sleep down there. And you get used to it in time, shell fire, and sleep through it, you see.
What was their sort of cubit? They used 7 or 8 feet down, you mean? Was that from the bottom of the trench? Where?
From the front line trench, you'd probably get down about, I should say roughly, about 6 feet, you see, down, sloping down, and make a gangway down there. There was usually a ladder there because it got worn with troops going up and down. You see, normally, you'd only have sentries in the front line. You wouldn't have, all the men wouldn't man the trenches. We used to have stand two in the morning.
I'll come to the daily routine. Yeah, would you? Is that where you keep your bags, any personal possessions or kit you had?
Yes. You'd have a place down there, perhaps about 2 foot wide, and that would be kind of reserved for you. Everybody would know it was yours, and everybody would put their things in their respective positions, you see.
How did the rations and supplies come up?
The
rations, how did they come up?
And supplies? The rations came up usually at night time. They came up on limbers from the transport, and they were manhandled, of course, up the communication trenches. They come as far as the end, we'll say, the safe end of the communication trench. And then the Russian parties used to go down. There was a Russian party detail for each company, and they would go down and fetch these very large Dixies, you call them Dixies. They were big tins about 2 foot deep and about perhaps 3 feet wide, and there'd be a handle on each end, and two men would carry one of them, you see.
What would you carry in the Dixies?
Well, chiefly soup. Soup with not too much gravy and that kind of thing for the midday meal, and iron rations, as we call them, the square biscuits, and bully, tins of bully beef and tins of jam, that kind of thing.
If you did get the hot meal, the soup up, would you eat it when it arrived, or would you attempt to reheat it later in the day?
Well, depending on the conditions, we would try and eat it when it was as warm as possible, but sometimes, usually, an attack was started at night and we couldn't get straight at it, and then we should have to leave it until the attack was over and we got settled down before we had the meal.
What was the quality of the tinned food you got? Do you remember anything about it?
Yes, it was pretty good. Practically all the jams were made by Ticklers. I remember it was Ticklers jam on the tin, and we could open them, of course, easily. And we had bread. Bread was brought up, and we had more biscuits than bread in the front line, what they call iron ration, and the biscuits are about 4 inches square, you know, each way.
What and were they like?
They were very, very hard, but they were sustaining, and for people who could eat them, of course, they were all right. People who had bad teeth used to have to soak them in water.
What about the tinned food? What was that like?
The tinned fruit was quite decent.
Tinned
fruit was
all
right.
You got tinned fruit?
Yes, and we got what we call McConaughey's. McConaughey's was a complete ration of meat and potatoes and beans and that kind of thing. You'd probably get one per man of that, and that was a meal in itself, really, McConaughey was.
What did you think of it?
I thought it was very good. Generally, the conditions, apart from the transport being shelled when they came up and got a direct hit, it's generally regular and very good, even in the front line.
Did you get enough of it?
Yes, we got sufficient. We could have done with more bread, but of course it wasn't. It wasn't really easy to get bread and to keep bread, because it really should go wrong. Then you got always the danger that there were rats in the trenches, in most of the trenches.
I'll come to. How did the water ration get to you?
How did the
water ration?
That came up in water carts, and we had 2 gallon petrol tins to take it up, carry it up the line through the communication trenches, and put in different places here all along.
Could you help yourself from those places?
No, each man was rationed to water. You had a mug, an army mug, you know, a tin mug, we used to call them. You'd have a mug full of that issued to you twice a day, unless there was anything you really wanted it urgently for, and then, of course, you'd have to ask the sergeant if you could have more water and he'd supply it or turn it down.
Did you get tea as well?
Yes, we got tea. You should have tea time in the afternoon. In the afternoon, somewhere about between 4 o'clock and 6 o'clock. And if we did get the rations up and could keep it hot, we would generally, where there's no attack on, we'd devour that right away.
Did you get enough water?
Yes, we got enough water, but we had to be very sparing regarding washing. We weren't allowed to do much washing.
What did the water... Was the water pure? Did it taste all right, or did it taste...
Yes, you see,
else?
It had already been chlorinated before it came up in the tanks. They had big water tanks, which were drawn by horses, you see, and I should think each army water tank would hold somewhere about 100 gallons, something like that.
So as far as you were concerned, the water just tasted like normal water?
Yes, except that you could taste when it was chlorinated. They always chlorinated to keep it from going wrong. It was slightly chlorinated.
What about any special rations? Did you get a rum ration in the front line?
Yes, occasionally. Now, there's a lot of deception about rum rations. I think the average public think that before we went over the top, we got a rum ration to instill a bit of courage into it. And it wasn't issued that way at all. Sometimes, although the front was absolutely quiet, we could get a rum ration. But it was because of the intense cold or very wet, you see. I always think that rum saved many a man's life. We didn't get too much. We'd get probably about, I'd say, 2 dessert spoonsful to a mess tin of tea. A mess tin would hold about a pint of tea or water.
But you didn't get it daily?
Oh, no, no. It would be ordered by the commanding officer that rum could be issued. Otherwise, we didn't get it, you see.
Did you drink normally in civilian life?
Yes, a little. Yes.
So you took your rum ration?
Oh, yes, I had my rum ration. Fortunately, there was one of my pals named Snadding. He was a big Salvation Army man. He didn't drink rum, so I got his ration as well.
What about cigarette ration? Any?
Cigarette rations were regular, and once a week we got a cigarette called Lloyd's, Lloyds, something like a Woodbine packet, 5 in a packet. That was the, we call it the official issue. And then, apart from that, some of the officers would send to England to their tobacco suppliers, and they'd send out a consignment for the whole battalion. You see, and the officer would pay it privately.
Did you smoke at the time?
Yes, but not too much. I did smoke. I smoked cigarettes. It was the only time I did smoke, as a matter of fact. I didn't smoke before I joined the army, but I smoked in the army, and I didn't smoke after I left the army.
When did you start smoking in the army? Was it in England, or when you got
England. I can tell you that I had my first pint of beer at Marlow. When we got down to Marlow, we went down one night, went with the crew, and we had a drop of beer there. I had my first pint of beer. I'd never had anything. I was about 20 years of age at that time, but I'd never tasted beer.
And cigarettes, you started about the same time then?
Yes, cigarettes roughly were started at Caterham, you know, when we were in training.
What made you start smoking cigarettes?
Because everybody else did, you know. You get in a crowd, they'd hand a packet of cigarettes around, you see, being kind of friendly.
Do you think the cigarette ration helped you with your nerves while you were in
the... Yes, I think it did kind of help you. If you were in a bit of a difficulty or anything like that, didn't feel too good, invariably you'd light up a cigarette. But, of course, you had to be very careful about... There was no smoking allowed in the front line, by the way. And another thing in the front line, it was a crime to go in the front line without your tin helmet on. Now, I've seen pictures on the television where troops are in the front line with no hat on. I expect you've seen them. It's all wrong. It never occurred in the British Army. You would get 14 days CV for being found in the line without your tin hat on.
As you mentioned it, we might as well cover the tin helmet. They were issued. You didn't have them when you initially went out. What did you think of them when you first got them?
Well, they were good protection. There's no doubt about that. Very good protection for the head, and we always found them very useful. We just carried them on the back of our pack. Your pack had a cross strap at the back, and your tin helmet went on the back of that when you're on the march.
Did you find them heavy or uncomfortable at first?
Yes, they were a bit uncomfortable. There wasn't much lining to them, but it was just sufficient to withstand the shock, we'll say, of a bullet or something like that. You didn't get the banging down your head. They were quite a good thing, and we always considered that our tin helmet was much better than the Germans.
Why? Why did you think that? What made you think that?
The Germans were shaped rather hideous, and they came round the ear portion, and I always think you'd be at a disadvantage if you couldn't hear, you see.
You didn't think the extra protection was worth not being able to hear then?
No.
Did you get any other special rations while you're in the front line? I mean, did you ever get anything else issue?
No, really. The food in the front line was very similar. There wasn't much variation in it. There couldn't be, you see, because it was a question of keeping it, and especially of keeping it away from the rats, because if you had any overs or anything like that and you threw them about, it only encouraged the rats to come.
What about your United Trench Warfare?
Oh, it stood very well, the khaki did, but in time, of course, we were replaced with them. Trousers, mostly, were tearing them on barbed wire. But tunics, they last a very long time, and they were fairly substantial and quite warm.
During that winter of 1916, you know, 15 into 16,
yeah.
What did you think of the... Did you get anything special issued? Did you get the woolen ones issued or leather?
No, we had, latterly in the war, I would think somewhere about 1916-17, we had what they called jerkins issued, which was a leather coat. And it was also lined. It had a fleece lining, and that was very good for winter wear. But they collected those in after the severe weather had passed. That went into the stores, and you didn't have them. Then it was reissued the next winter, you see.
Would that be the winter of 1916-17?
That's right. I can always remember in early 1916, we had a very bad... very bad attack of frost, and we were in under canvas at a place called Maripar, and it was bitterly cold, and even when you had water, which you used to get for your shaving, the lid of your mess tin took off, and you always to fill that overnight with water for shaving next morning, you see, and you had ice on the top of the...
That was Maripar, you said.
Maripar,
that
yes.
That would be January 1917.
Yes, that was near to Albert, not far from Albert.
That's into 1917,
yes.
Just into 1917.
And we were under canvas. A tricky dinner on Maripar, we got settled in there.
Anyway, I'd like to stick, if we can, mainly to the Ypres area before, you know, because we'd really, that's our main
yes,
thing
I
at the moment.
Yes, I see what you mean, yes.
That's all right, though. I'd like to ask about, you said that you didn't get much opportunity to wash. What arrangements did you make to wash in the front line?
Well, there were canvas buckets, and so many of you would dip into a bucket, perhaps 10 of you would use the same bucket, you see. But it was quite all right as far as it went, just for the time we were in.
Were you expected to shave in the front line?
Yes. Well, no, not all, that, again, was subject to condition. If it was a fairly front quiet on the front, you were expected to shave, and the sergeant would use... would shout the order out, you see, in the particular section. He'd say, shaving today, you see, and he'd give it out, and then you'd have an inspection to see, yeah, it had shaved.
Was there any difficulty in shaving with the cold water?
Well, there was in it. I suppose your skin got tough to it, and the trouble was this, that I'd never used a razor before I joined the army, but we were issued with cutthroat razors. They're the only one we had. We didn't have any safety razors in those times. They weren't invented.
What about latrines? What did you do for latrines?
Well, latrines, you had to go to the rear, what they call the rear trenches. There were special trenches built or dug by this pioneer battalion. They used to do all this work behind the trenches. And they were deep, and there was a pole and trestles, you see, at each end, and you used to go and sit over the pole. And when, of course, when that one got filled, they filled it up and dug another.
Did they provide paper or anything for you?
Well, yes, but usually you used to get an old paper, perhaps coming from England or with your parcel or something like that, you see. You'd always save a bit of paper for your own personal use.
So it was your responsibility to find your own
That's
paper?
That's right, yes. They didn't provide any army paper.
About how far back from the front line were these latrine trenches?
Well, generally speaking, of course, it varied a bit according to the line where you were, but I would say about 10 yards, perhaps, behind the front line. There was no smell of it because they had plenty of disinfectant up there.
Did they lead off the front line or did they lead off the communication trenches?
Both. They led from the front line and from the communication trench.
Would they be zigzagged or...?
Yes, usually zigzagged. But they'd follow more or less the contour of the front line, you see, back behind.
Was it strictly enforced that if you wanted to go for any reason, you had to go to the latrine trenches in your battalion?
Oh, yes, yes. You couldn't do it in the front line. You made it kick you out.
What about waste disposal? Because I know it sounds funny, but there must have been a lot of tin cans and things from the rations. How did you dispose of them in your battalion?
Well, there were special bins provided up in the front for you to throw any waste, but you were forbidden to throw, of course, any paper about, especially in the front line. They were very particular about cleanliness in the front line. You couldn't leave any refuse of any description there or anything which was going to smell or go rotten.
So you'd put any refuse, the cans and things, you'd put into this sort of bin affair.
Yes.
What was the bin shaped like?
Well, actually, I think that there were petrol tins that had been cut off. You see, only small things. They contained perhaps about 2 gallons of water, if they held water, but that was for refuse.
And what happened when
they were emptied every day.
Who by?
By one of the, what we used to call, swabs. Each section would have what they call a swab, and he would be the man who would mostly see to the rations and empty these bins and that kind of thing.
Do you know where he would empty them to? Where he would take them? Would he bury it or what?
Yes, it would go to the rear for disposal, but I don't think it would probably be thrown into the same place as the toilets in the deep trench, you see.
How were these swabs, as you called, selected? Were they bad soldiers, or did they volunteer?
No, everybody took a turn. You were detailed for swabbing, you see, for that day, 24 hours. Then another man took over, you see, the next day.
Did you have any trouble with lice while you were at Ypres, or any time?
Yes, generally all the time there were lice, and even if you got a new issue of clothing, which was very seldom, you'd soon get what we call lousy again. Of course, people used to say they were straw lice, but they weren't. They were body lice. They were bred. You could pick them off your skin, especially in your private parts or underneath your armpits. In the warmest parts of your body, they used to accumulate, and you couldn't. No matter what you did, we used to have a preparation called Harrison's Pomade come out from England in parcels to destroy them, but it didn't destroy them.
How were they a nuisance? Was it just their movements, or did they bite, or what? How were they a nuisance to you? Was it just knowing
they'd bite. They'd bite, yes, a little bite with them. But you were never free of them. No matter. Even when I came on leave to England, my mother used to get off of a shirt and burn it. She wouldn't have any lice. And even if you boiled, they say you didn't properly exterminate them.
You tried this pomade. What other methods did you try and use to get rid of them? Were there any other?
Well, if we were back at rest, we used to sit out in the sunshine and delouse, pull them out, you see.
Out of the seams?
Yes, but you could never properly rid yourself. Nobody, I don't think, even the officers, they would suffer from just the same. You see, it was for want of baths. Now, baths were only available when you went back to we'll call it a civilised town, where it was populated, and usually they used to make for the brewery and cut the old beer tubs in half and place them for us to make a bathroom of it. But that would only occur probably in 2 months, I would say, roughly. And, of course, by that time you were filthy again.
What was the procedure when you had a bath?
You used to line up in your platoon. They'd detail number one platoon who would say at 12 o'clock, and number two platoon would follow at 1, you'd know what time your bath was, you see. You'd march down, the 60 men in a platoon. Say you had your time was 3 o'clock, you'd get to the brewery and you'd undress and put your clothes wherever you could. It was all very, very rough, usually cobbled bottom, and all these half tubs would be there. Well, after each 60-minute bath, the water would be thrown away, and you get some clean water. And the 60 of you would go into tubs of perhaps about, among 60, perhaps be 20 half tubs, you see. So it'd be three in a bath, you might say. You'd be first, second, or third. You should hurry up and dress to be the first one in the bath, you see, to get the cleanest water.
You say your clothes were just put off. Were they not? Were your clothes not steamed dry or cleaned while you were having?
Well, that's when we used to get a new issue of clothes. We handed our old clothes in as we stripped. They were handed in, the vest and pants and shirt, and then when you came out, you were handed fresh ones. Whether they fitted or not, if they're a bit tight under the armpits, you didn't have to grumble, you had to put them on.
Were you given a full? Were you given jacket and trousers, tunic and trousers as well, or did you just get the underclothes and shirt?
Just a minute, I didn't get that.
Did you get a full uniform when you had a bath, or did you just get the underclothes?
Oh, no, just the
shirt?
Underclothes. No, your uniform stayed with you all the time. That's your tunic and your trousers. And
was that not washed while you were in the bath? Because I was thinking that would have the lice in as well, wouldn't it?
No, I believe, I don't know exactly what happened. Of course, we left it behind, but I think that was fumigated and reissued. We always thought so.
What about rats in the trenches? You've mentioned them two or three times already. How were they a nuisance to you, and how did you try and overcome them?
Well, they'd come round and disturb you at night sometimes when you sleep, you see, and if there's any food about, they were a real nuisance. But, of course, they were only in some parts of the line. Curiously enough, you get into a sector, there'd be no rats at all. You get perhaps another mile down the line and no rats. But I think they were like agricultural from farms and places like that had been there in peacetime.
They got at your food, did they? How did you try and stop them getting at your food? Were there any measures you took?
Oh, you'd hit them with an entrenching tool handle or a bayonet, something like that. We killed no end of them, of course. We used to sometimes fire a shot at them. It wasn't allowed, but I just happened to let off a few at one.
Were you successful in keeping them off the food?
Yes, generally. Well, you'd put them into something that you'd got substantial, like a tin. You never got much food hanging about because you instantly ate it up when it came up in rations, you see. You weren't allowed to store food in the trenches, especially in the front line.
Did you have any problem with any other pests during that time? I'm thinking of mice or maggots, flies.
No, we didn't have much trouble with anything else. Rats were the chief thing. Rats and mice. Lice, yes.
Was there a problem with the proximity of dead bodies and such like from previous actions?
No, because it was all done systematically. They had what they call clearing up men. Most stretcher bearers generally were the men who handled the dead bodies and took them and buried them. They'd usually bury them a little bit further back than even the second line, communication line. They'd dig a big pit and probably, throw 20 or 30 in as many as were. The great thing about a dead body, you had to collect the identity disc, you see, before it was handled or buried.
So there were none left in the trench area. What about in no man's land? Were many left out there?
There would be a lot left out, but they would be recovered subsequently by either the Germans or by us, and there was a kind of an understanding between each of them if they were going to collect wounded or dead, you see, in no man's land, and nobody would fire.
How would you know? How was that policed, so to speak?
Usually they'd put up a signal, like a white flag or something like that, or we would do the same, you see. Well, then for perhaps an hour in that sector, there'd be no firing at all, and they'd go out and collect the wounded and the dead and bring them back to the respective
line. Did you ever have to take part in collecting the dead?
Yes. Everybody in turn had it, and you got used to it and didn't take any notice of it. It's just like collecting timber. When you've been at it, you just get hold of them, put them on a stretcher, and off you go back again, and they'd be put in the hole.
Was it a nerve-wracking thing, these truces, when you're out? Because you're out in the open.
Well, no. You could trust Jerry very well that he would not fire on you or anything like that. There'd be no danger of the enemy firing at the time, and it was usually done about 12 midnight to 2 in the morning, the what we call the dull time, and then you get back to your trench.
So both parties would be out at once?
Yes, they could be. that I've known the times when they have been, but not necessarily to keep rigidly to a certain time. You see, they you get the signal, and you get the signal to say no firing. You see, until you get the word of command again. You see,
will this come through the officers?
It came, yes. Well, through the officers, it was imparted to us by the non-commissioned officers, but it had come from the officers, actually.
And how often would this occur, or would it just be after a major
attack?
Well,
again, that depended upon conditions of fighting, you see. If there'd been a very big skirmish or fight or anything like that, there'd be, of course, a lot of dead and wounded. And, of course, the wounded had to be moved first. That was another point, because you could got a chance of saving a man's life. The dead would be there at any time and for you to collect afterwards.
So as far as you were concerned, there was no problem with dead bodies rotting on the battlefield and creating a horrible smell?
No, there were no dead bodies left in trenches. And you see, every battalion, when they were in the line, had to keep it clean and leave the line clean. If they left dead bodies in there, they'd be for it, you see.
So smell wasn't a problem to you?
Oh, yeah. No. Well, again, that...